In January 1928, Stalin himself travelled to Siberia to investigate the drop in grain deliveries. He ordered the forcible gathering of grain and blamed the shortage on the so-called kulaks, who were hoarding their harvest in the hope of higher prices. Kulak usually meant a peasant who employed a couple of labourers or owned a pair of cows. However, the NEP had failed. A radical military solution had to be found for the food crisis. Stalin was a natural radical, and now he shamelessly stole the clothes of the leftists he had just defeated. He and his allies were already talking of a final new revolution, the great turn leftwards to solve the problem of the peasantry and economic backwardness. The peasants had to be herded into collective farms, their grain forcibly collected and sold abroad to fund a manic gallop to create an instant industrial powerhouse that could produce tanks and planes. Private trade in food was stopped. Kulaks were ordered to surrender their grain and prosecuted as speculators if they did not. Gradually, villagers were forced into collectives. Anyone who resisted was a kulak enemy. The resulting rural nightmare was like a war without battles, but with death on a monumental scale. Similarly, in industry, the Bolsheviks unleashed their hatred of technical experts, or bourgeois specialists, actually just middle-class engineers. While they trained their own new red elite, they intimidated those who said Stalin's industrial plans were impossible with a series of faked trials. Nothing was impossible. Yet the warlords of this struggle, Stalin's magnates and their wives, lived in the Kremlin like a surprisingly cozy family. This small group of ruthless idealists were the engine of a vast and awesome revolution. They would build socialism immediately and abolish capitalism. Their industrial program, the 5-year plan, would make Russia a great power, never again to be humiliated by the West. Their war on the countryside would forever exterminate the internal enemy, the kulaks, and return to the values of 1917. The plan demanded a 110% rise in productivity, which Stalin insisted was possible, because everything was possible. "To lower the tempo means to lag behind," explained Stalin in 1931, "and laggards are beaten, but we don't want to be beaten." The Bolsheviks could storm any fortress. Any doubt was treason. Death was the price of progress. Surrounded by enemies as they had been in the Civil War, they felt they were only just managing to keep control over the country. Hence they cultivated tvyordist, hardness, the Bolshevik virtue. Bukharin resisted Stalin's revolution, but he and Rykov were no match for either Stalin's patronage and charm nor the Bolshevik taste for recklessly violent solutions. In 1929, Trotsky travelled into exile with a look of stunned hauteur on his face to become Stalin's mocking critic abroad, and his ultimate symbol of treason and heresy at home. Bukharin was voted off the Politburo. In November 1929, Stalin intensified the war on the peasantry, demanding an offensive to deal the kulak class such a blow that it will no longer rise to its feet. But the peasants refused to sow their crops, declaring war on the regime. On the 21st of December 1929, to celebrate Stalin's official 50th birthday, each of the magnates wrote an article in Pravda, hailing him as the Vorcht, the leader, Lenin's rightful heir. The magnates realized they had to liquidate the kulaks as a class. In January 1930, Molotov planned their destruction. The kulaks were divided into three categories. First category, to be immediately eliminated. The second, to be imprisoned in camps. The third, 150,000 households, to be deported. Molotov oversaw the death squads, the railway carriages, the concentration camps, like a military commander. Between 5 and 7 million people ultimately fitted into the three categories. During 1930-31, about 1,680,000 people were deported to the east and north. Within months, Molotov's plan had led to thousands of rebellions involving more than 800,000 people. Kaganovich and Mikoyan led expeditions into the countryside with brigades of troopers and armoured trains like warlords. In Kaganovich's photograph album, we find him heading out into Siberia with his armed posse of leather-jacketed ruffians, interrogating peasants, poking around in their haystacks, finding grain, deporting the culprits, and moving on again. The peasants believed they could force the government to stop by destroying their own livestock. The despair that could lead a peasant to kill his own animals, the equivalent in our world of burning down our own house, gives a hint of the scale of desperation. 26,600,000 head of cattle were slaughtered. 15,300,000 horses. On the 16th of January 1930, the government decreed that Kulak property could be confiscated if they destroyed livestock. If the peasants thought the Bolsheviks would be obliged to feed them, they were mistaken. As the crisis worsened, even Stalin's staunchest lieutenants struggled to squeeze the grain out of the peasantry, especially in the Ukraine and North Caucasus. Stalin berated his magnates, but even though they were often 20 years younger, they replied with tantrums and threats of resignation. He often had to take back his own words. The foundation of Stalin's power in the party was not fear, it was charm. Stalin possessed the dominant will among his magnates, but they also found his policies generally congenial. Although he was older than almost all of them, the magnates used the informal you with him. Voroshilov, Molotov, and Serbo called him Koba. They were sometimes even cheeky. Mikoyan signed one letter, "If you're not lazy, write to me." In 1930, all these magnates, especially the charismatic and fiery Sergo Argenikidze, were allies, not protégés, all capable of independent action. There were close friendships that presented potential alliances against Stalin. Sergo and Kaganovich, the two toughest bosses, were best friends. Voroshilov, Mikoyan, and Molotov frequently disagreed with Stalin. Stalin was a gifted organizer. He never improvised, but took every decision, weighing it carefully. He was capable of working 16 hours a day, but his real genius was something different and surprising. When he set his mind to charming a man, he was irresistible. Everyone who saw him was anxious to see him again, because he created a sense that there was now a bond that linked them forever. "Artyom," said Stalin made, "we children feel like adults and feel important." Visitors were impressed with his quiet modesty, the puffing on the pipe, the calmness. In the eyes of rough Bolsheviks from the regions, his flat, quiet, public speaking was an asset, a great improvement on Trotsky's oratorical wizardry. Stalin's lack of smoothness, his anti-oratory, inspired trust. But above all, he was supremely intelligent, a political genius, and thus able to dominate his entourage. Nonetheless, this self-anointed messianic hero worked hard to envelop his protégés in an irresistible embrace of folksy intimacy that convinced them there was no one he trusted more. Stalin was mercurial, but far from a humorless drone. He was convivial and entertaining, if exhaustingly intense. "He was such fun," said Artyom. Once, when Kozlovsky, the court tenor, was performing at the Kremlin, the Politburo started demanding some particular song. "Why put pressure on Comrade Kozlovsky?" intervened Stalin, calmly. "Let him sing what he wants." He paused. "And I think he wants to sing Lenski's aria from Onyegin." Everyone laughed, and Kozlovsky obediently sang the aria. When Stalin appointed Isakov as naval commissar, the admiral replied that it was too arduous because he had only one leg. Since the navy had been commanded by people without heads, one leg's no handicap, quipped Stalin. In 1913, when he stayed in Vienna with the Troinovsky family, he gave their daughters sweets every day. Then he asked the child's mother to whom would the girl run if they both called. When they tried it, she ran to Stalin, hoping for some more sweets. This idealistic cynic used the same incentives with the Politburo. When Mikoyan moved to Moscow, Stalin lent him his apartment. When Mikoyan loved the apartment, Stalin simply gave it to him. When young provincial Beria visited Moscow for the 17th Congress, Stalin himself put his 10-year-old son to bed at Zubalova. Every gift suited the recipient. He gave his Cossack sabreur, Budioni, swords with inscribed blades. He personally distributed the cars and latest gadgets. There is a list in the archives in Stalin's handwriting assigning cars to every leader. Their wives and daughters wrote thank you letters to him. Then there was money. These magnates were often short of money, because wages were paid on the basis of the party maximum. Even before Stalin abolished this in 1934, there were ways around it. Food hampers from the Kremlin canteen and special rations from the government stores were delivered to each leader. But they also received packets, secret gifts of money, like cash in a brown envelope, and coupons for holidays. When he noticed that his staff was short of money, he secretly intervened to help them. It used to be regarded as ironic to call the Soviet elite an aristocracy, but they were much more like a feudal service nobility, whose privileges were totally dependent on their loyalty. The party was almost a family business. Whole clans were members of the leadership. Kaganovich was the youngest of five brothers, three of whom were high Bolsheviks. Stalin's in-laws were all senior officials. Sergo's brothers were both top Bolsheviks. A tangle of intermarriage complicated the power relationships and would have fatal results. When one leader fell, everyone linked to him disappeared into the abyss, like mountaineers roped together. The backs of the peasants, in Stalin and Molotov's chilling phrase, were indeed being broken. But the scale of the struggle shook even their most ruthless supporters. In mid-February 1930, Sergo and Kalinin travelled to inspect the countryside and returned to call a halt. Stalin had lost control. The masterful tactician bowed before the magnates and agreed to retreat with resentful prudence. On the 2nd of March, he wrote his famous article, Dizzy with Success, in which he claimed success and blamed local officials for his own mistakes, which relieved the pressure in the villages. Even in stormy times, Politburo meetings at midday on Thursdays could be surprisingly light-hearted. Stalin never chaired the Politburo and was careful never to speak first, so that no one was tied by his opinion before they had stated their own. There was much scribbling across the table at these meetings. Bukharin drew caricatures of all the leaders, often in ludicrous poses with rampant erections or in Tsarist uniforms. They were always teasing Voroshilov for his vanity and stupidity, even though this hero of the Civil War was one of Stalin's closest allies and had become defense commissar in 1925. If Stalin approved of a leader's speech, he passed an enthusiastically scatological note. A world leader! Fuck his mother! I've read your report, you criticized everyone! Fuck their mother! He wrote approvingly to Voroshilov, who wanted more praise. Tell me more clearly, did I fail 100% or only 75%? Stalin retorted in his inimitable style. It was a good report. You smacked the asses of Hoover, Chamberlain, and Bukharin. Signed, Stalin. Serious questions were decided too. During a budget discussion, Stalin passed a note nudging Voroshilov to stand up for his department. They're robbing you, but you're silent. When his colleagues went back to discuss something Stalin thought had already been decided, they received this across the table. What does this mean? Yesterday we agreed one thing about the speech, but today another. Disorganization. Stalin. The Politburo could sit for hours, exhausting even Stalin. Listen, he wrote to Voroshilov during one session, let's put it off until Wednesday evening. Today's no good. Already it's 4:30 and we've still got three big questions to get through. Sometimes, Stalin wrote wearily, military matters are so serious they must be discussed seriously, but my head's not capable of serious work today. However, Stalin realized that the Politburo could easily unite to dismiss him. Rykov, the rightist premier, did not believe in his plans, and now President Kalinin, too, was wavering. Stalin knew he could be outvoted, even overthrown. The new archives reveal how openly Kalinin argued with Stalin, "You defend the kulaks?" scribbled Stalin. He pushed it across the table to Papa Kalinin, a mild-mannered former peasant with round spectacles, goatee beard, and droopy moustache. "Not the kulaks," Kalinin wrote back, "but the trading peasant."
"But did you forget about the poorest ones?" Stalin scrawled back. "Did you ignore the Russian peasantry?"
"The middling sort are very Russian. But what about non-Russians? They're the poorest," argued Kalinin.
"Now you're the Bashkir president, not the Russian one," Stalin chided him.
"That's not an argument, that's a curse." Stalin's curse did descend on those who opposed him during this greatest crisis. Every criticism was a battle for survival for this thin-skinned, neurotic egotist on his messianic mission. During these months, he brooded on the disloyalty of those around him, for his family and his political allies were utterly interwoven. Stalin had every reason to feel paranoid. Indeed, the Bolsheviks believed that paranoia, which they called vigilance, was an almost religious duty. His paranoia was part of a personal vicious circle that was to prove so deadly for many who knew him, yet it was understandable. His radical policies led to excessive repression that led to the opposition he most feared. His unbalanced reactions produced a world in which he had reason to be fearful. In public, he reacted to all this with a dry humour and modest tranquillity, but one finds ample evidence of his hysterical reactions in private.
"You cannot silence me or keep my opinion confined inside," Stalin wrote to Voroshilov during the struggles with the rightists. "When will these attacks on me end?" Stalin.